This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
Ground control to Major Tom. Control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom. Commencing countdown, engines on. Check ignition and may God's love be with you. Papers want to know whose shirts you wear. Now it's time to leave the capsule if you dare. This is Major Tom to ground control. I'm stepping through the door, and I'm floating in a most peculiar way. And the stars look very different today, for here am I sitting in a tin can, far above the world. Planet Earth is blue, and there's nothing I can do. Something wrong. Can you hear me, Major Tom? Can you hear me, Major Tom? Can you hear me, Major Tom? Can you hear? Am I floating around my tin can, far above the moon? Planet Earth is blue, and there's nothing I can do.
You're listening to the Electric Sheep Film Show on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Electric Sheep Magazine Assistant Editor Alex Fitch, and the track you've just heard, as if you didn't know, was a live version of Space Oddity by David Bowie, recorded in 1969. Our opening track predicts the interview I'll be conducting later in the show with the director Andrew Martin and lead actor Edmund Kingsley of a new excellent Cold War sci-fi thriller capsule about a British astronaut trapped in a space capsule orbiting the Earth. Also in tonight's show, I'm talking to Lee Broughton about his book Eurowestern, which explores the nature of gender and minorities in European Westerns in the 1950s, 60s and 70s. And also Electric Sheep magazine editor Virginie Selavy will be talking to Nag Vladimirsky, the festival director of the London International Animation Festival. To start off then, here's my interview with Andrew Martin and Edmund Kingsley about the sci-fi thriller Capsule. Set in an alternate 1950s, where the Brits made it up into space before any of the other powers, mainly set within the titular capsule, in which a British astronaut is desperately trying to find help to return his capsule to Earth, and finds himself in increasingly taut conversations with Americans and Russians as his craft inadvertently flies through their radio zones. The interview was recorded on stage at this year's Sci-Fi London Film Festival, so you'll have to forgive the background noise. So obviously when you're making a low-budget science fiction film, the concerns are, how do I limit the number of members of the cast? How do I restrict the number of sets? You came up with a perfect solution.
Yeah, one man in one small capsule, which was 3 meters long by 8 foot in diameter, yeah. Which you basically spent 2 weeks in, sat down patiently, which I would in turn grateful for. And then, one location at the end with a single tank, which, it's expensive, but it served a purpose.
Is that an example of Soviet brutalism in Billericay?
Possibly. That end shot is actually Hornsey Town Hall, in North London.
Okay.
So we took it over for about 4 days, got our art department in, and transformed it from a town hall, which was a bit run down, and into a Russian base. So,
fantastic.
Yeah.
Obviously, when you have a single actor pretty much on screen for the entire running time of the movie, you have to have a lot of faith that he'll be able to carry the film pretty much single-handedly. I mean, can you tell us a little about the casting process?
A bit crazy. So we kind of had an idea of what we wanted. We wanted someone who had kind of the hero-esque look, and have a kind of, because it's the 1940s, 50s test pilots, we needed to have someone who had this charisma and kind of had that presence on screen, and Ed just fitted that bill so well.
And had that fitted in the suit as well.
You did. That was a yes. for your height. It's tricky, because you actually wouldn't be a test pilot at your height.
I did never choose somebody my size to sit in a tin can for that long, because I don't think they'd get the nasty kind at the end. In fact, I knew it was the nasty kind at the end. Crunching a bit.
Yeah.
Had you done anything similar to this? I mean, I guess the only thing that would be similar would be sort of an extended monologue.
I don't think there is anything very similar to this, really. In some ways it was more like, I think I drew more on theatre experience than film experience, because there were lots of very, I think our longest take was 20 minutes.
Wow, 20 minutes. So we actually shot 46 minutes of the movie in one day, which must be a record. So, I apologise now to Paul and Bob for kind of being there for 20 minutes at a time in single takes, but we got it done.
Cool.
And it also means we had two cameras running at the same time, so intercutting in between is great.
But obviously you weren't depriving the box again, so it was okay.
No.
But it was because Andy also was responsible for an awful lot of what was actually inside the capsule, and often between setups I had to sit in there, and just being in there, being in Hermes for hours on end, did an awful lot. I didn't have to do very much acting if I'm trapped in a capsule, or if I've been trapped in a capsule for a few hours.
Do you suffer from claustrophobia?
No, that's the other thing you were selecting for when you were casting.
Yeah, definitely. It's such a small space, you could actually touch both walls and
yourself. Yeah, we were all quite into it.
It was.
I mean, the timing of this film is obviously very pertinent. We've had Chris Hadfield up from the ISS. Mm-hmm. Was that one of the motivations filming this now?
Not really. We've had this idea several years ago, and we knew that we wanted to do something that was kind of contained, and it kind of more came from that, the entire thing. And then kind of time with everything in Russia and everything happened as well, so it's kind of worked out. We've kind of slightly predicted what's happened. That's slightly scary with a few things, but that's kind of where it came from.
Obviously, not to spoil this for the audience, the text at the end wasn't
true in terms of there being a secret British mission, but were there any kind of things like that in released Russian files?
The whole thing's inspired by events that could have happened.
Right.
So...
Yeah, because you know, I heard some of the files that were released after a number of years. It was things like, you know, we were saved from nuclear annihilation because of a Russian soldier at the post saying, even though all of these displays are telling me to launch mm-hmm. a nuclear war against America, I believe it's just birds flying overhead. Yes. He was right, but he was probably sent to a gulag afterwards because of that.
Probably, you
know,
yes.
That sort of thing.
We'll never truly know what happened over the... Even after the 30-year rule, when everything was going to be released, we'll never fully know what happened during that Cold War and how close we came. Mm. And this, theoretically, could have been one of those instances, but that's kind of a reflection.
But there was a British rocket programme.
Yeah, we
did have the beginning of our own.
We did. Yeah.
That was one that Bernard Quatermass worked for, wasn't it?
I think so, yeah.
I got a small laugh in the audience, though. Not nerds enough. But actually thinking of the kind of British science fiction that we had in the 50s, I mean, you had things like Dan Dare, you had things like Quatermass.
Definitely.
Did these feed into the kind of story that you wanted to tell?
I'm not familiar with those, but kind of that period, definitely. And we wanted to kind of convey the look of a 50s film, and I put that solely down to Felix, and kind of he knew exactly what he wanted in terms of the look and the lenses and everything, and we worked together as a team and kind of put together the look of the 50s. We did have those inspires, and we had a lot of stuff from Kubrick that we wanted to kind of bring in, taking certain shots. So there were influences from all around, really, kind of bringing in the 50s, 60s kind of cinema into it.
I mean, Edmund, you were saying that once you got into the craft, it kind of helped heighten the atmosphere. Mm. But a lot of acting is about having something to act against, to react against. When it is just you, how did you kind of conjure those kind of emotions of panic and terror?
Well, I mean, the ship was sort of a character in itself. Mm. So Hermes is sort of the other character on screen, misbehaving and tripping me up. And I did have, actually she's here, Naomi was sitting feeding all the lions, doing her best Russians and Americans and everything. So I did have somebody in real time.
We had Naomi feeding the lions,
she was great. But it's also about a man trapped on his own. Mm. So actually being stuck on my own, not really having it. I mean, I did have, obviously, there was lots of people on the film set, but actually everything I saw in front of me was what Guy would have seen. It was, and the other brilliant, which I think comes across, is all of quite a lot of the bits of Hermes are real bits of aircraft, and they felt right and they smelt right. It's kind of the bakelite and kind of heavy, all those the fuses that come out, a proper heavy solid things.
And also, the actual Earth you see through the window was actually there. We actually front projected that, so there's no CG involved with that. That's actually there on set. So you sit in the cockpit and you see Earth outside the window, which you're in there for hours. We had a 90-minute video of Earth kind of as a full rotation. So that was playing, and we moved it to the point where it needed to be in the orbit. And so that was kind of fully there the entire time. So yeah, you did feel like you were in a capsule.
So actually, in terms of what was around me and what was feeding my imagination, there was plenty to go on, even without other physical actors in the room. It was a lot to lean on and a lot to take ideas from and react to. And it was great. It was a good bubble to be in.
And I hope you don't mind mentioning this, but I heard before the film started that it was very much a family affair, that your dad helped build the sets and your mum helped make the costumes.
It was. Well, the costume was designed by Hilary Wiley, who did the costume for Sam Rockwell in Moon. So my mum used to be a kind of do soft engineering and stuff, and she actually embroidered the Union Jack logo that's on his arm and the tailor, and yeah, my dad used to be an engineer, and he kind of helped me out with various things, and it's been a massive team effort from everyone. It's just been amazing kind of working with everyone on the crew.
And what was your background before making this?
Well, I'm actually a model maker and special effects technician. That is my background. Okay. So that was 14 years ago, 13 years ago. So I did that, and then I started writing, and then I bought a camera and started doing my own stuff. So that's kind of how that all started, and then here we are opening Sci-Fi London, which is just incredible. So thank you. Where's Louis? Is he somewhere? Probably in the process.
Yeah.
Cool. Does anyone in the audience have any questions for the director and star?
Do you think this put your film puts Billericay firmly on the map of British filmmaking? As on the local board?
Hopefully.
Thank you.
It's actually Rayleigh, but yeah, it's similar. Yes, we've tried to kind of push Rayleigh quite a lot in it. We had a good few months there, for sure, and Bob's place, so, indie film. So.
There was one in that sort of past the room.
Yeah, it's... Oh, that's very loud. Two quick questions. The first... I must take this away. It's a bit loud. The first question was, it gets very conspiratorial as you get on because the Americans and the Russians are involved. And it's 2 years after Sputnik and 2 years before Alan Shepard and Yuri Gagarin and John Glenn and so on. Did you decide to go down that route? You wanted to... Because everyone's suspicious of something going up. You know, 2 years after Sputnik. I mean, it's not just a spacecraft. It's a person. Someone therein.
We definitely wanted to play on that conspiracy. That was the kind of the beginning point. We always wanted to have everyone playing off against each other, and him not knowing what was going on, and him at a room guy's point of view trying to work out who to trust and how to get back. And at the end of the day, he has to figure out himself how he wants to do it, and trust who he feels that he should trust, and whether or not that's the right person is another matter, but it's the one he chooses at that point. But we strategically put it at 59 for multiple reasons, and on the 4th of December 1959 as well, for a certain reason. So, which is the Americans actually launched a test craft on that day for the Apollo, for the Mercury. So it's set on that reason, which is why the craft crashes into it in the end. So.
And the second quick question is, at the end of the film, the Russian space center, wherever it is, that's in Rayleigh somewhere, I assume, in Essex, it's not in Russia.
That's Hornsey Town Hall, that's North London, so Wood Green. So, which served as well for the period we were there.
First of all, impressive, it kept my... God, it's also a delay here as well, isn't it? It kept my attention, and for 90 minutes, that's impressive, especially consistent just one man wearing a spacesuit. The Man That Ate There in 1961, starring Patrick McGowan. Do you remember that?
I don't, sorry.
An interesting film about a Russian astronaut trapped in a faulty space rocket. Mm-hmm. It was an interesting take you've gone there with... the Russians being the villains, because you could actually reverse that and have the Americans being the villains, couldn't you?
You could.
And they're basically the same plot.
Basically, everyone has their own agenda.
I beg your pardon. That was the ending I was expecting, actually, that it was the Americans who were going to hit, make him crash in Russia to
Well, we decided with the Russians kind of being it, so...
Thank you.
You're welcome. How
do I answer that?
It was always kind of worked out that way. So we needed to kind of plan our plot points to get to that position. So, okay, no worries. Thank you for coming.
Any other questions? Down the third row. We've got a shout from the back.
Very loud voice, so I'm doing another microphone. I'm fascinated by your spacesuit design because I've been to the Cosmonaut Park in Russia and seen their original spacesuits, which are all held together with wing nuts and agricultural designs like that.
Sounds like an answer, yes.
Particularly the space helmet fascinated me. That seems to have some lovely sort of bolts and clips on it. And I just wondered how you came about designing the spacesuit and the helmet. Did you have any basic engineering information on that?
No, we had initial design. We had a picture of something that we liked, and
which was from where?
I don't actually know where it was from. I think we found it online somewhere.
Was
kind of no, it wasn't. The actual helmet is a 1970s MiG helmet, which we modified quite heavily. So before it had like a fabric skirt at the back of it, so we actually had to make those locking rings and everything. So they're actually made out of plastic with aluminium filings in it, so you wouldn't know it. So we had this kind of fiberglass skirt made on it, and we had, instead of a flat front on the visor, we actually had one vacuum form, so it actually had a kind of a bubble shape to it, which kind of gave it quite a different look. And we moved a few things and added headbands and details just to kind of make it a little bit different. And also because it would be a solid white or a grey object in that environment, we wanted to give it light and show light and tone and shadows, kind of so you get lots of detail and definition in it, to kind of give it that kind of look. So,
thank you.
But Hilary did a great job with designing it, and we've got it at home. So. And it's a really nice piece. And we chose the blue specifically for the film, so cobalt blue, which is kind of down the lines of the old RAF uniforms. So it gives that kind of RAF.
Yeah, it's got an RAF blue colour.
Yeah, that lineage to it.
Yeah. Thank you.
No worries.
Congratulations, guys. That was amazing.
Thank you.
Yeah, really amazing film. And I just wanted to ask quickly, it says at the end, obviously, this is based on a true story. Sort of. How much of it, what did you take from the original Hermes mission? And was there, like, dialogue? Or how much was influenced by real life in any shape or form?
It's more the scenario that could happen. So we had... the knowledge of the Black Knight test rockets and kind of that side of everything, and then we've fictionalized everything else from it, which is a bit crazy. So the actual rocket, the Black Knight rockets, were tested on the Isle of Wight. They were launched from Woomera in Australia in December. Rocket number 7 disappeared. From the launch schedule, so that it skipped a number, it went from 6 to 8. So we're kind of resolving it around events that happened, and we've kind of come up with the story of this is what could have happened during that thing. And it's not beyond the realms of possibilities that we could have actually done this at that time. We were leading the world in rocket technology and engine technology, and the Russians were buying stuff from us and stuff. So it would theoretically
going to
happen.
Any other questions?
Yeah.
So the film ends with a really impressive sort of Steadicam stitch continuous shot, which was lovely and, you know, very well done. But I wondered why you chose to do that in offices of the Russians who we've just met, and rather not something in space with your main protagonist, and take those resources to do that?
Basically, we from the very first moment that we all sat down, myself and my producer sat down and went through the story, we always had this idea of having the ending in Russia. So it was there from before the script even existed. So we always knew that we wanted to bring it back to Earth in some way, shape or form, and whether or not Guy was going to be there, or in something, either voice or actually in person. We always knew that we wanted him to be about what happened to him, but not actually see what happens to him. I think it's kind of more powerful that way. You hear him on the radio, you hear his last words, and he's calling for his wife, who then turns out to train him. So, yes, that was kind of always our goal.
End it on a downer.
Not quite a downer, but kind of on that kind of paranoia, and suspicion. So,
right at the back.
It is loud. I just wanted to say that thank you for taking the actors who speak actual Russian. Because as someone who speaks fluent Russian, it annoys me when in Hollywood they speak with a terrible American accent. So well done on that part.
Thank you. Unfortunately, Jed, who's one of our actors, couldn't be here tonight. But he was great, and he could speak fluent, and the other guys knew it, but needed kind of prompting with it. But yeah, we always wanted to go with kind of speaking it in Russian and kind of getting it as accurate as possible. So thank you. We're glad that came across. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to be greedy and ask another question.
Go ahead.
His lady stroke girlfriend or muse or whatever she was.
Yeah.
Was her, the way she spoke, early on in the film, she said, you need not need worry. She said, not need worry. I thought, that doesn't sound grammatically correct. So was it deliberate, the way she spoke was a bit sort of stilted in?
An award to that man in the back. Yes, it was.
Yay!
There are clues hidden throughout the entire movie to her lineage. Sorry, say that again. Indeed, that's what we wanted. We wanted to kind of have that slightly off tone to it. And so, okay, but then you kind of part gloss it over. But there are multiple other clues within the movie, so I'd highly urge you to kind of... Yeah, we've got like four or five other things in there, which we won't spoil for now.
He wants you to buy the DVD.
No, that would be ideal.
She knows one.
That's also something, yeah. And there's also there's one in that thing where she also calls him kitten, as well, which is another term of endearment. So there are other visual clues as well on screen. Certain words and certain colours and all that kind of stuff is all thematic.
Oh, good.
So,
thank you
for spotting it.
Yeah.
Hi. Just a quick question. You said it's a low budget. I'm interested the budget, what it was. If you can say that.
What do you think it
is? £1 million.
I wouldn't dare to guess.
I'll pass for the moment, but it was enough. But we've basically outdone ourselves, I think. And like I say to all my team and crew here, just thank you so much. And without you, this wouldn't have happened. Can I get a round of applause for that?
Capsule, directed by Andrew Martin and starring Edmund Kingsley, is available now on DVD. And to find out more about the Sci-Fi London Film Festival, where the Q&A was recorded, please go to sci-fi-london.com. Coming up next is Virginie Sellevy's interview with the director of the London International Animation Festival, Nag Vladimirsky. And to put you in the mood for all things animated, experimental, and mainstream, here's Shonen Knife with Buttercup, a song inspired by the Powerpuff Girls. We'll be right back.
this year you're opening with the films of Chris Shepherd, who already featured in last year's programme, I believe. So the festival seems to have a very special relationship with him. Why is that?
Okay, well, Chris, in the end last year, couldn't turn up for his screening. He was ill at the last minute, so we just had to cancel his screening. So what we did last year, because people had already bought quite a few tickets to see Chris speak, along with some other animators who could make it, we decided to do a pre-recorded interview with Chris from his house, which we actually projected at the Horse Hospital. So in a way, Chris was there virtually, not physically, and everyone absolutely loved that format. It was only sort of like a 25-minute interview, but it was... Chris is an extremely engaging person. He's always got a lot to say. He's very funny, very witty. And just screening that interview at the Horse Hospital to a packed house went down extremely well. So after that, I said to Chris, we must try and get you, book you for this year's festival, which we have done. And it's coincided with the world premiere that we have of Chris's new short film, which is called Jono's Dead, which is he's been making for about 6 or 7 years, and it's a follow-up to a film he made 12 years ago, which was called Dad's Dead, another short film, which both these films are extremely sort of hard-hitting, quite violent depiction, slightly autobiographical, about his early days growing up in Liverpool. We'll be screening that along with Chris and members of the cast up on stage on opening night.
Sounds great. Is he one of the most interesting British animators working at the moment, in your view?
Yeah, I'd say so. For various reasons. He works equally in live action as in animation. And he mixes styles up within the film. So, in fact, Jono's Dead is a hybrid film of live action and animation. And all different styles of animation as well. He can... he's an amazing draftsman, so he can draw beautifully. He makes lots of music videos. He does lots of titles. He works in the commercial world as well as making his own independent short films. He's been making films for about 20 years now. He does a lot of comedy as well. I think there's just a basic sort of truth to his work, which really comes through. Because he's just a great person, a great talker as well, and he's sort of known very well within the animation industry, it should be a real pleasure to have him up there on stage and just to try and pick his brains and sort of like ask him some questions about, working in both animation and live action fields.
And you've got other programmes focusing on British animation. So what is new in British animation this year? Have you noticed any trends or any different styles, innovations?
We always have a British showcase screening. That's actually now moved to our opening night as well, because basically a lot of the animators are happy to come along and talk about their films just before the screening as well. So we screen about 15 films, probably 10 or 12 of the animators will be up there on the stage with us at the beginning, introducing their films and happy to chat to the audience afterwards in the bar. In terms of different styles and techniques, there's a lot more animated documentaries coming through. Noticed primarily from the film schools, probably the three biggest film schools in the UK are Royal College of Art, National Film and TV School, and the Edinburgh College of Art. And about half of the British showcase screening is made up of the best films from those schools. And I've noticed a lot of filmmakers veering towards making documentary-type films. I think there's a... Maybe there's a need for filmmakers to want to sort of speak some truth or put their message out. And documentary is a great way of saying that. And animated documentary is a sort of growing genre. And
are there any particular subjects that dominate those documentaries?
Well, there's all really very, very different. There's a marvellous film actually by... very young student from Middlesex University, which is a very new course, a woman called Adara Todd, and she's made a film called Twiddly Things, and it's based on her grandmother's sort of descent into Alzheimer's. It sounds very heavy, and it is quite a sad, heavy subject and heavy film, but the way she's sort of put the whole film together, there's moments of absolute beauty and joy as well. So that's one that I particularly really like. There's a film based on a woman's prison, which is just conversations with women in prison and just their sort of thoughts and their sort of processes, and that's again quite a heavy film, but again sort of moments of real joy in there as well, sort of females, sort of women sort of bonding in the prison. There's a film by Anna Ginsberg, made at the actually it's her first film since she graduated from the Edinburgh College of Art, which is called Private Parts, and that's a sexual film all about things we generally don't talk about.
Sounds great. And you often focus on the more obscure corners of the animation world, but this year you're showcasing some classic early Disney shorts from the 30s and 40s. So why did you decide to include those in the programme?
We've actually been chasing those films for about 2 years now, so it's been a very, very long time coming. And I knew that these films were out there. They've restored 35mm prints, and I saw them at a festival in Canada about a year and a half ago, and they look absolutely beautiful. They've only screened 3 or 4 times at other festivals, and it's got all of the basic characters that we just sort of all remember and love, like Donald Duck, Mickey Mouse, Goofy and Pluto, etc. They're from the 1930s and early 1940s, and I just thought it's about time that people sort of, people that know and love these characters got a chance to see them again in restored prints on the big screen, and also hopefully there'll be maybe some adults who would take their kids along to see them for the first time. You know, obviously these characters exist on YouTube, you can see them, but there's nothing like seeing them in a cinema. And they're just looking back at them, the stories are absolutely timeless, the characters are timeless, and it will be, exciting to see them up there on the screen again.
And you have another retrospective screening with the English premiere of the first Japanese anime, which was made in 1945. It's called Momotaro Sacred Sailor. How did that come about?
We've been working quite closely this year with a Scottish distribution group called All The Anime. They're fantastic. They know everything there is to know about anime in they release Blu-rays and DVDs, but they also are there at their distributors as well. And I knew this film was out there. It's an interesting story because it was made in 1945 and it's classed as the very first ever anime film. It was thought lost for about 60 years until I think it was the director's niece actually found the film underneath her uncle's bed. So, and she sort of like took it to some film studio in Japan, in Tokyo, and they realised it was this lost classic. So it's only had, again, it's like only had about 4 or 5 screenings around the world. We've got a DCP version of it, and it's just an amazing story. You can just see where anime has come from. It's very, very bizarre, but absolutely beautiful, beautifully restored film.
And it's a propaganda film, isn't it?
And it's a propaganda film, yeah. It's a Second World War propaganda film, yeah. Really quite bizarre story. You know, fans of anime, you know, you really have to come and see it, because it will, you can just see where everything came from this film.
Excellent, okay. And you often have a focus on a specific country in the festival, but I don't think you have one this year.
No, we decided against it this year. We've almost sort of like done a full, feel like we've done a full circle. We were very close to screening actually an independent American session, but to be honest, we've got so much other stuff going on, we just ran out of screening slots. But we're thinking of doing a mid-year mini festival next year. It's on the cards, probably at the Horse Hospital, and maybe around about April time, because we have so much stuff left over that we actually couldn't fit in this year, that we really want to screen it. There's basically a 3-part screening that we put together, which in the end we just couldn't put together, of independent LA, Los Angeles films, which are just wild and fantastic, but just couldn't quite squeeze it in this year.
And it's a 10-day festival, so that's an amazing amount of material you've got to screen if you can't fit all of it into all your slots.
Yeah, to be honest, there's so much stuff out there, and it's always we're spoilt for choice. I mean, the competition screenings are the bulk of the festival, and this year we have 8 competition screenings of the best recent films. But along with all the special screenings, we're screening as well some stuff in partnership with Animated Women UK, which are a relatively new organisation promoting rights for women in the film industry. So we've got a screening in partnership with them of the best women films made by women and edited by women, and there'll be a panel of women talking at that screening. We've got 4 feature films as well this year, stuff like The Late Night Bizarre Session, which always does very well, the sort of craziest films of the festival, and also screenings in conjunction with Edge of Frame and Animate Projects, who are these 2 animation organisations, which will be focusing on the more experimental animation, and that will be at the Close Up Cinema and Whitechapel Gallery.
And going back to the women animators, do you think, because there's been a lot of talk of women directors recently and how difficult the situation is, if you're a woman and you want to direct a film, do you think it's easier or more difficult for women animators, or how what's the situation?
Well, interestingly enough, when I the way I approached this screening, I knew the organisation existed, Animated Women UK. We actually put on a panel with them about 5 years ago, and I think it was the very first genesis of their organisation. I went through all of the films that we were screening in competition this year and basically handed them over to them to put together their own screening. When I sort of counted up all the films in competition, there was actually 55% of the films are made by women. So I think that shows that very, very healthy in terms of, more women than men are screening. And I hadn't, we just choose the films on the basis of what they're like, not obviously not on gender, but it was I sort of had an idea that it was about half, but to know that there was more was quite a surprise.
Very interesting. I'm very intrigued by your secret screening. You've got a feature-length animated feature which involves biker gangs and secret cults and is hand-drawn by two American artists. Can you tell us any more without revealing what the film is?
All I can say is it's made by a filmmaker who's made several feature films before. This one is the first one he's actually made in partnership with somebody else who has got a history of being around biker gangs and being involved with biker gangs. The film, we're not allowed to reveal the title or the filmmaker because Sundance Festival are insisting on world premiere. But they actually, the filmmakers themselves, approached us because we've screened most of these people's films before. They approached us and said, would we like a secret screening? We know that many people have been along to see these guys' films before and love them. And so that we've got a history of supporting these people's films, and they're great, and they're just perfect for the Horse Hospital audience again. So can't name the filmmaker, but it wouldn't be too hard to dig around the internet and find out.
Okay, that's very exciting. And are there any films that really surprised you or shocked you or moved you, or where you had a particularly strong reaction in the programme this year?
Have to say the opening night film, Jono's Dead, Chris Shepherd's new film, is really very, very shocking. Extremely hard-hitting, not too much light in there. So people that do come along for the opening night screening, it actually won't be the only opportunity to see the film because it's also screening in competition in a session of films called Into the Dark, which are the darker, more sort of violent, more horror type, creepy type films. So it's in that session as well. That's a film that really does stand out for me, and again, extremely glad and proud to have the world premiere. I'm sure it will go on to sweep, you know, win loads and loads of awards, you know, over the next year or two.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
The London International Animation Festival runs from Friday the 2nd of December till Sunday the 11th of December. And films include the opening night gala, The Warped, Wonderful and Terrifying World of Chris Shepherd, Window Horses, The Longing of Michael Dodok DeWitt, the British premiere of an ultra-secret feature, and various classic and international shorts. For more information about the London International Animation Festival, please go to liaf.org.uk. Finally on today's show, I'm talking to Lee Broughton, author of a new book on Euro-Westerns published by IB Taurus, which looks at the portrayal of various minorities in Westerns in the 1950s, 60s and 70s to find a new nuance present in the narratives of Westerns from England, Germany and Italy. Broughton's book touches on such themes as the other, depictions of the carnival in Westerns and the presence of strong female characters in the British Western, which suitably for the time we now find ourselves living in, the author sees as something present when society goes through periods of crises of masculinity, such as the appeasement of Hitler and the end of empire, things which have something of a resonance in today's political climate. To put you in the mood for classic Euro-Westerns, before you hear my interview with Lee Broughton, here's an extract from the soundtrack of Django Prepare a Coffin, featuring Nicola DeBari, singing the film's title song.
Spy, you better never cry. A man like you should never shed pity. Spy, Each time you better smile. When things go wrong, so wrong, you wish today, today. I know it's hard to smile that day. Your girl is gone away, and you are in love. I sometimes you better lie. A man like you must keep his pain inside, inside. I know it's hard to be alone the day you miss someone. Each time you better smile, so you get lost and wander home alone, 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 alone,
So I'm talking to you today because of your book Euro Western, published by IB Taurus. It's an interesting collection, but it's broadly divided into three sections. One looking at the depictions of race in Italian Westerns, another looking at the favourable depiction of Native Americans in Westerns from Germany, and then finally strong female characters in British Westerns. And as ever, looking at a book like this, you come to it with certain sort of preconceptions about what you expect from the Euro Western. I mean, personally, I've seen a number of spaghetti Westerns, but wouldn't think of, say, Britain as somewhere that produced many Westerns. The only one that springs to mind, I guess, is Carry On Cowboy. And certainly, while Germany produced the likes of Klaus Kinski as a heavy in various Westerns, again, the German Western isn't something that many audiences know about. Were those kind of concerns that you brought with you to the book in order to sort of broaden people's knowledge of what the Euro Western is?
To some extent, I guess so, yeah. I mean, I was definitely interested in looking at European Westerns as a phenomenon that encompasses Italian, British and West German Westerns. And as you say, the ones that most people are familiar with are the Italian ones. But each country has its own kind of distinct story to tell, it seems, when they engage with the Western. They kind of bring local concerns and local cultural considerations to the genre, and they kind of twist it to suit their own ends. And that's when we start seeing these interesting patterns emerging, like African-Americans in the Italian Westerns being sort of in control of their own destiny and quite rebellious, but not being punished. And similarly, the Indians in the German Westerns and the women in the British Westerns.
I interviewed Matthew Sweet a number of years ago, and he said to me something along the lines of, a lot of people expect culture to be representative of the country that it's made in, but not enough people actually look at counterculture and sort of B movies and the things that are somewhat underground. And that's a theme that you very much tease out in this book, that, for example, in the Italian Westerns, there is some reflection of the marginalisation of people from southern Italy, and these are reflected in the casting of black characters in these movies.
Yeah, indeed. Italy is divided on the north-south axis. We've got kind of white Europeans in the north and then Italians with darker skin that inhabit the south. And there's always been a kind of cultural, economic and racial divide there. And people have picked up in the past the fact that Italian Westerns often foreground Mexicans as leading characters and the whole kind of Catholic milieu that goes with that. And that in itself has been adjudged to kind of represent contemporary Italy. But I think it can be taken to a further level, which I have done with the representation of African Americans. Because when Southern Italians were travelling to the north during their time of economic decline in the late 50s and early 60s, they used to be kind of given a fairly rude reception, and the Northern Italians would indeed refer to them as Africans and sort of racially insult them along those lines. So there is a kind of correlation to be drawn there between African Americans historically in the West, perhaps, and Southern Italians in the kind of mid-20th century onwards.
Mm. And another aspect of the Euro-Western that I have to admit I knew nothing about until I read your book was this interest in Native American-focused German Westerns from the 50s. It sounds like it's another kind of B-movie genre, a bit like the German Krimi that were popular around, mm-hmm. the same time. But I guess, you know, the German Western is something that's almost forgotten in terms of film history.
Yeah, to an extent, again, it is the case. But this kind of goes back to the previous century, really, to the late 19th century, when there was a whole kind of wave of a kind of whole literature movement centered around Western stories in Germany, written by German authors, the most famous being Karl May, in which German adventurers linked up with Native Americans and had harmonious relationships with them, and quite often assisted them in defending themselves from attacks from antagonistic white settlers and the American cavalry, etc. And this, for some reason, the kind of Winnetou two stories in particular, the ones that Karl May wrote, are really huge in Germany. They have been ever since they were first published, and literally it seems every German comes to a certain age and they read the Karl May stories. And this, along with various other kind of cultural stereotypical in some senses, some of the kind of cultural links, but there's a significant number of Germans who have a kind of acknowledged affinity or feel an affinity with Native Americans. And Germany is the country where we do get, I think, the biggest number of German hobbyists, and these are people who actually spend their weekends or their free time dressing up as Native Americans and travelling out of the country and kind of trying to live that lifestyle and researching Native American lifestyle, etc. So that's kind of one aspect of the kind of German culture which indeed comes out in these films. When the Germans started making their own Westerns in the 60s, they kind of automatically adapted their own literature. And so what we end up is with these films, which have very positive depictions of Native Americans. Hollywood Westerns always had a lot of rules regarding what ethnic minorities and females could do in film. And the European Western, we tend to have these characters breaking these rules. And certainly we see in the West German films things like interracial romances between whites and Native Americans, but there's no punishment at the end of the film. They're quite okay to kind of end the film as a couple and that kind of thing. Mm. And it's funny that when Germany split into, was divided into the two countries, East and West Germany, the communist East Germans, the authorities there frowned upon Karl May's work and forbid the films to be shown there, but they did find that their citizens were actually travelling to other Eastern Bloc countries where the films are allowed to be shown, watching them there. And so in order to counter this death of the East German film studio, the state-run film studio actually had to start making their own series of Indian-related films that kind of fit with communist ideology.
Mm. Well, and one thing, one of many things that you mentioned in the book that was fascinating was the idea that when the Americans came to Germany and liberated the country after the Nazis, some of the films that they were using to kind of popularize American culture and show that their sort of cultural hegemony was something to be proud of were films that showed the massacre of an indigenous population, which surely is exactly what they'd just been trying to fight against.
Indeed. Yes, indeed. And I think there's also a suggestion that, which I do cover in the book, that these films from the 60s that the West Germans made, invariably they do involve episodes where a tribe will be wiped out in a kind of genocidal manner, and one of the German characters will be accused of being involved in this atrocity, but he will prove his innocence, and he will prove that actually, no, he doesn't believe in that kind of thing, and in fact, he's a friend of the Reich or other. So there's a kind of suggestion that these films somehow assisted the Germans in working through what had occurred during the Second World War, and allowed them to look at stories of which involve racial hatred, but actually place themselves in a different position, in the position of those who actually defended the racial other.
And indeed, that you suggest that there's some sort of sense that this othering that Germans see in these American movies is somehow a cathartic thing for them, again, after the rule of the Nazis, in order to be able to promote the roles of Native Americans in these movies. It's some kind of, you know, cultural frisson that they're supporting the underdog in these movies, you know, having a generation earlier, you know, committed genocide themselves on their own shores.
Indeed, yeah, it does appear that the films, because the films were made at a time when the Adolf Eichmann trial was occurring in the early 1960s and various other war crimes trials. So obviously it was something that was in the public discourse. It does seem that these films perhaps appeared at this time as a way of assisting in Germans working through what happened in the previous decades and what was actually happening at the moment, trying to get past that point.
Mm. It seems that in a lot of kind of film genre research, at least until recent years, people tend to look at things in isolation. For example, with Italian westerns, people might think of the films of Sergio Leone and his contemporaries, but not then consider the giallo that followed or the crime films, even though these genres shared a lot of the same creatives. And it's really interesting when you're looking at British westerns that you very much tie the British western tradition into the British horror gothic tradition and suggest a number of connections between the two.
Yeah, what interested me about the British westerns is that the ones that, which there's two kind of cycles really, a kind of comedy, a cycle of comedies from 1939 to 1966, and then a cycle of more serious spaghetti western influenced films which were made in the early 1970s. Now, the ones which were made in the early 1970s were made in a transnational context. They had British producers and some British personnel, but they also had kind of personnel for hire from overseas, and a number of them were actually shot on spaghetti western locations in Spain. Mm. So these films are often judged not to have much Britishness in them. But when I looked at the comedy films initially, I could see in there, obviously, the music hall, because they tend to have, they tend to be kind of parodic vehicles for music hall stars like the Crazy Gang, Arthur Askey, and of course the Carry On team. And they also have these peculiar allusions to gothic horror, which really do stand out, even if it's just a case of having a particular focus as in Carry On Cowboy on the kind of funeral director and that kind of coffin imagery and the Undertaker imagery. But when I then looked at the second cycle, the ones which from the 70s, which are judged to not really be that British, they still have the kind of same concerns in there. Kind of gothic horror, certainly gothic horror, but there's some very peculiar interludes in these films which make them look like things from Hammer films. And it does seem the kind of company which made the most westerns of this time, a company called Benmar, their westerns just seem to be like westerns with a horror film waiting to burst out. And in the end, they stopped making westerns and actually made a pretty good gothic horror express with Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee. And the other thing that ties the two cycles together is this idea of the strong woman. Now, in the comedy films, it it seems that the presence of these emasculated, unnatural music hall types like the Crazy Gang and Arthur Askey create this filmic space for strong female characters to occupy and, of course, break the rules of the Hollywood Western at the same time. But what we find is that when we look at the 70s Westerns, these strong women are still there and they're still breaking all these genre-related rules. And the kind of big one, I guess, is Honey Calder, which Time Gun Films made in 1971 with Raquel Welch. And that is essentially the first Western really in which you have a female leading her own revenge vendetta against three groomers who killed her husband and raped her.
I mean, it's interesting that you talk about how these British Westerns almost were en route to turning into horror films. And you speak in the book about the early prejudice there was against Euro-Westerns, in particular spaghetti Westerns, seen as some kind of pale imitation of American Westerns. And it's interesting, perhaps, if you think of spaghetti Westerns as, again, a genre that's about to flip over into horror. Perhaps if people had been a bit more flexible with their definitions of genre, they might have been more accepting of the Italian Westerns in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, indeed, I would agree with that. And I think the basis for this kind of prejudice lies in the idea that the Western is actually America and Hollywood's own genre. The very fact that it purports to show American history allows Hollywood to make claim to that one genre certainly being its own. And when we have people from other countries attempting to engage with it, it seems that cultural purists and American filmmakers also get very upset, and they can't understand why another nation would want to engage with their history. But what then happens is we have a kind of canon of films which are all American films when we look at the Western by and large, and there's a kind of genealogy too, and any developments in the genealogy of the Western are always accredited to American movies, and that might be because at certain points they reflect cultural changes in America, or at certain points they reflect innovations within Hollywood itself. Never really are any innovations brought by Westerns which were made outside of the USA acknowledged. And quite often when these people looked at European Westerns, they saw them simply as inept efforts to make a Western. You know, the very fact that you had an African-American behaving in a certain way, or a woman behaving in a certain way, or indeed a Native American behaving in a certain way, or horror elements or circus elements, etc. These were judged to be mistakes that these foreign filmmakers had made because they didn't understand how to make a Western. It wasn't kind of accepted that, hang on a minute, actually what these people are doing is manipulating, you know, they're not making mistakes, they're actually manipulating this film form in order to address local cultural circumstances. And that's the kind of argument made in the book, really, is if we think about progressive representations of the other in the Hollywood Western, and the films which are put forward that are deemed to have introduced those progressive representations within the Hollywood form, invariably we find that if we look outside of Hollywood, there's cycles within the European Western whereby those progressive representations actually appeared in the European films first.
Mm. Well, indeed, you cite the example of an African-American actor who was able to get leading roles at considerably higher salaries in European Westerns than he was in any American movie.
Yeah, Woody Strode. I mean, he was a well-known face in Hollywood, and he worked with John Ford quite regularly. But John Ford did tell him quite bluntly, you know, you'll never be a star simply because of the colour of your skin. So just make the best of it as a character actor. And I think he used to get paid about $4,000 a week on a John Ford movie. But when he went to Italy and he starred in, got his first starring role in a spaghetti Western after a guest spot in Sergio Leone's Once Upon a Time in the West. His first starring role was in Giuseppe Colizzi's Boot Hill. And Colizzi just kind of plunked $70,000 or so down on the table and said, you know, you're a star, as far as I'm concerned, and you're going to get a star salary.
Mm.
And he went on to enjoy quite a long career in Italy, where he was really well regarded as a leading man and a star.
Mm. Lee Broughton's book, The Euro-Western, Reframing Gender, Race and the Other in Film, is available now from IB Taurus. Being an academic book, it's not a cheap title by any means, but you can find copies on Amazon for a third off the RRP. If you do buy Lee Broughton's book, which is well worth a read, then films which he recommends as exemplars of little-seen British, German and Italian westerns are Harold Ramis' The Treasure of Silver Lake from Germany, Sergio Corbucci's The Great Silence from Italy, and the little-seen British film Robert Parrish's A Town Called Bastard. For fans of interdisciplinary approaches to European media and entertainment, while not film and TV, this year's Graphic Brighton Festival is taking place on the 9th and 10th of December at the University of Brighton campus in the centre of Brighton. This two-day festival is looking at portrayals of war and conflict in comic books, and guests include Dave McKean, filmmaker and cover artist of Neil Gaiman's Sandman, who'll be talking about his latest graphic novel and multimedia project, Black Dog, The Dreams of Paul Nash, husband and wife graphic novelist team Brian and Mary Talbot, who'll be talking about their book The Red Virgin and the Vision of Utopia, and Kate Evans, who'll be exploring her graphic novel Red Rosa, a graphic biography of Rosa Luxemburg. Across the two-day conference, they'll be joined by manga creators, young illustrators from the crowd-funded collection Brighton's Graphic War, and many others. The 9th of December is an academic conference, and public events start on the evening of Friday the 9th and all day Saturday the 10th. You can find more information about the festival by going to graphicbrighton.wordpress.com, where there are links to buy tickets on the University of Brighton's online store. The Electric Sheep Film Show was recorded and edited by Alex Fitch, including an interview with Nag Vladimirsky, recorded and conducted by Virginie Selavy. You can find all previous episodes of the Electric Sheep Film Show at www.electricsheepmagazine.co.uk/events, and we'll be back on the third Wednesday of next month at 5:30 p.m. Next month's show is somewhat improbably our 50th episode, and I'll be joined by actress Katie Manning, Tom Large, the director of a new British sci-fi thriller Arcadia, and Virginie will be talking to the actress and producer Marcia Dovales. In the meantime, while we're still thinking of Euro Westerns, here's another extract from the score of Django Prepare a Coffin, featuring music by Gianfranco and Giampiero Reverberi, with a classic bit of Euro Western score, which might sound familiar to fans of Gnarls Barkley. Thanks for listening.
This program has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.